They want me to get rid of my dog. Can they do that?
I'm being fined for leaving my garage door open too long.
What are covenants? Do I have any rights?
Help, I feel like I've left the American zone.
If you want the answers to those questions, join me, Sue Bartholomew, and my guests on The Commons every Saturday from 2 to 3 right here on WBR Fairfax Radio. We'll ask the experts and we'll untangle the truth about what's left of our property rights. On the Commons is a weekly radio show dedicated to discussing the many issues surrounding mandatory membership homeowners associations. Join us as we explore this relatively new world of controlled living, which includes condominiums, cooperatives, and both attached and detached single-family homes. Living in a common ownership development means giving up the American dream. It means giving up your constitutional rights and control over your most valuable asset, your home. Living in a homeowners association means leaving the American zone. This is On the Commons, and I am Sue Bartholomew. Joining me on the Commons today is Chuck Welsh. Chuck is a former developer, so he knows the whole sordid mess inside and out, but that didn't help keep him out of the courts for 10 years. And he has just come out of a four-year lawsuit. So, Chuck, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for sharing your story with us and hopefully preventing others from going through what you've been through.
Thank you, Sue. How are you today?
I am great.
Wonderful. I'm speaking to you from beautiful Martha's Vineyard, Massachusetts.
Wow.
And it is a lovely day up here. And so, yeah, you and I have spoken about this briefly, and I guess I'll just get into the story, and hopefully what I can share will help your listeners.
Thank you.
So what this is about is about a condominium development in Jacksonville, Florida. And this occurred about 10 years ago. There's two parts to this story. One is how this actually came about, and then the second part is about the actual legal process and what advice I could give to people if they ever unfortunately find themselves in a position where they feel like they have to take legal action. This was new construction, and I guess if I have to start out with any recommendation for anybody, don't ever buy new construction that involves a homeowners association, because you have no clue what you'll end up getting yourself into. At least with an existing HOA, as part of your due diligence in purchasing, you can maybe go to a board meeting or meet the board members and ask the right questions. That's what I recommend to everybody. That gives you the flavor of whether or not you're getting yourself into a good or a bad situation regarding an HOA. With new construction, it's completely different because you start with a blank slate and have no idea what the future holds. And this, unfortunately, was the case with me in Jacksonville. This was a brand new condominium development that included a marina. And I signed the contract to purchase pre-construction before it was built. And the only reason I did is because I'm a boater. I'm a big boater. I'm actually on a boat up here in Martha's right now. And the whole reason I did it was because the idea of living on the water. I was a U.S. Naval officer for 6 years and drove carriers in the U.S. Navy. And so it's just always been in my blood. And so anyway, signed the contract to buy this condominium, which took longer to construct than they had originally anticipated. It was delivered about 6 months late. When I did the initial walkthrough of the condo, I asked about the marina because I was paying separately for the boat slip that I was going to be parking my boat in. And there were some unique caveats to how the ownership of that boat slip was set forth. But the bottom line is it appears that they hurried the construction. And by all accounts, I guess they were excavating this marina and possibly ran out of places to take the dirt. And from my experience and from what I saw, it looks as if maybe they just flooded the marina before they had fully excavated it. So what we had been promised in depth was not what we received. And so immediately upon closing, people were bringing boats in and they were running them aground. Only a small portion of the condominium purchasers actually bought boat slips. They had this development itself has 85 condominiums, but only 45 boat slips. And of those 45, only 22 were purchased. And of those 22, only about, over the course of 7 or 8 years, only about 7 boats ever came in. because it was so restricted in its navigation. Well, this started out politely with the developer, who, by the way, happened to also live in the building. He lived in the penthouse, lived in one of the penthouses, and I'm sure you can imagine how that all works. And so he was in control of the board, and we started out with polite, you know, look, you got to get in, you got to dredge this marina, you got to make this thing navigable. And there was nothing was done, and then, of course, the housing market collapsed, and suddenly these condominiums were worth half of what everybody had paid for them. So that only increased the tension because you couldn't really leave. It wasn't like, well, I'll sell it and, you know, I'll take myself elsewhere. Everybody was underwater in these things. And I don't believe they've actually recovered to their purchase value of 2006 to this day. So what happened is tensions began to rise. And I actually ran a boat in and out of there quite a bit and was running aground. So I was becoming pretty vocal. I had actually done about $1,500 damage to my boat just hitting the bottom in the marina coming in one day. So anyway, it got a little contentious. We were trying to get the developer off the board. It turned into a small minority of people complaining against a large majority who didn't really have any interest in the marina, the fact that they just enjoyed looking out at it and looking at the manatees. And so we were able to get the developer finally, and unfortunately it was after the 5-year statute of limitations on construction defects and things like that, that he stepped down from the board, and the turnover process was completely incorrect in accordance with Florida law. There was no proxy, anything. It was more like an ad hoc meeting where, you know, there was some nominations and he nominated someone and that person was appointed as the new president and sort of handpicked by him. And then we were able to get a couple of folks on the board that were acting in the interest of the marina. There was discussion of a lawsuit to get the marina dredged properly and get the proper construction done on it. But there was a blowback on that because the developer had appointed the president. And so the president took action about 6 months after these two gentlemen were put on the board. And of course, they had contacted a lawyer, were looking at filing a lawsuit. And she had them removed from the board. She had a couple of what I call flying monkeys that kind of ran around the building and were able to lobby signatures to take these two fine gentlemen, by the way, one a retired U.S. Navy captain, kick them off the board. And so from there on, They kind of went about their business and didn't have any interest in the marina. So needless to say, and I'm sure many of your listeners have been to contentious board meetings, the board meetings started getting a little heated. I'm sure you're all too familiar with that, right?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. So anyway, I was pretty vocal. Again, I'm 50 years old, former naval officer. I tend to speak my mind. And I guess that ruffled a few feathers. And so I was out on my boat one afternoon. And came in early evening into the marina, and there was some fellow who had rented a slip there. He wasn't even an owner in the building. And I brought my boat in, docked my boat, and really nothing out of the ordinary, out of anything I'd ever done. And I don't know how this all came to be, but 2 weeks later, I had a friend call me and ask me if I'd checked my mail. And I said, don't. And he said, go check your mail. And I went down and looked, and there was a letter that had been sent out naming me that I had conducted or had operated my boat dangerously in the marina, and that if anybody were to see me essentially operating my boat again, to call the police on me.
Wow.
It was atrocious. Yeah, and a number of the residents.
Okay, let me interrupt you. Why would they call the police? What was the police supposed to do?
Nothing. I mean, the police doesn't.
I was going to say, that's not.
Right. It's a private marina. I owned the slip, which I paid $150,000 for, by the way. And, you know, and I'm a licensed merchant mariner. I'm a former naval officer. And it was strictly an attack on me personally to silence me. That's what it was about. And fortunately, I had friends there who sort of reacted to this in the form of emails to the president and to the management company who had sent out the letter, without contacting me first, and spoke out in my defense. I saw him. He's operated his boat in here 100 times. Never had a problem. you know, they were very helpful. Apparently, this response did not please the president of the board, who had been appointed by the developer. And so she decided to send out a second letter. And this one was much stronger. It used words like harassment, danger, used very terse language in reference to me. And again, I've never, you know, had any issue on the water in my life, and I'm running an 85-foot yacht right now. So anyway, when this second letter went out, I had a number of people in the building say, you've got to sue, you've got to sue. And they didn't even care that it was there. They were members of the HOA, and they would essentially be co-defendants. They said, you have got to sue for this. And it was a tough decision to make, but I guess it was about 4 months, 5 months later, I filed a civil complaint in the Fourth Judicial Circuit of Duval County. Complaint was for defamation, invasion of privacy, and breach of contract. And so thereupon, we entered the legal process, Shu, and that brings us to part two of this story, which I think will be very beneficial to your listeners.
Okay. And just before we go to part two, I've been taking notes here. And mm-hmm. one of the things you said right at the top of the show was you recommended that people attend board meetings prior to purchasing. And one of the things that we have discovered is that you are one election away from having everything turn around. I tell people there's no such a thing as a good HOA or a good condominium, because even if it's wonderful today, it's going to turn around tomorrow. So
right.
be
Politics.
Aware of that.
Right, sure. I don't disagree with that at all. I mean, we see that in any political arena. But you're right. But again, I mean, when you get into established, we are moving into a cycle. I was reading in USA Today a couple of weeks ago. I don't know if you saw the article, that most boomers are done buying. Okay, the boomers are done buying. They're where they are, and they're pretty much that's where they're going to live out their lives. So that's good in the sense that it creates some possible continuity in some neighborhoods and buildings around the country. So, you know, at least you're able to get in there and see what the general, you know, what the general climate is. So, I mean, I guess that's the only good part about that. But I agree with you completely. HOAs and condominium associations are probably the most horrid thing on the planet. So when one goes to file a lawsuit against one's own HOA, there are two things to keep in mind. One, if you're going to keep living there, it could make your life difficult, and you've got to go through the process itself. Now, HOAs are all insured, as you know, correct?
Right.
So that means that their defense attorneys are insurance defense attorneys.
Right. Right. And some of them don't know their elbow from a hole in the ground.
Well, and they also come from the lowest bottom of whale leftovers on the bottom of the ocean. So, okay. So anyway, I filed suit, and I guess it was about six, and I moved out. I left my furniture and everything there, but I evacuated. And let's see, I was deposed about 6 months after filing the suit, and getting the proper lawyer is key.
Yeah.
I think a lot of plaintiffs' lawyers are reluctant to take HOA cases.
Yes.
Because they know that they are contentious, they are nasty, they are emotional. They're more emotional than a car accident. Because if somebody hits me in my car and injures me, at least they didn't do it on purpose.
That's a great point, because in an HOA, it is being done on purpose.
It is malicious, 100%. It is absolutely malicious. So I was deposed, and we went through a general legal process that over the first year and a half to 2 years just kind of drug itself out through depositions. And in Florida, you can't request punitive damages in the initial complaint. You have to amend your complaint to add additional, to seek punitive damages in a jury trial. And that has to be done through an amended complaint, as I said. And I filed for that, and basically it was on the grounds of malice. So this is a malice case where, as we just said, it was done intentionally to harm. And the judge agreed. He said, you make a valid point. And so we'll have a, you know, two-part trial. We'll look at your, you know, let a jury determine whether or not you are to be awarded compensatory damages, which, as far as I'm concerned, it was my loss of money on the value of the condominium. And then the punitive damages, which in Florida can go as high as $3 million. So it's kind of interesting. Yeah, it was interesting process. It's all up to a jury. Okay. I mean, it's got to be determined by a jury, and only if you're, only if they're found, you know, only if they're found at fault in negligence. Well, went through the whole process, but an interesting, where this thing got gummed up is in Florida, when you, when the court allows punitive damages to be a part of the award, if you will, the defendants have to produce their financial net worth information. Now, in my case, I had initially only filed suit against the HOA and the management company because the management company sent out the letters, and it was, I believe, the responsibility of the management company to have known better, even though the president of the association requested they do it. And again, this is simply an act of vindictiveness. The management company should have been professional enough to know that you just don't do that. You don't, you don't distribute a letter to every single member of an HOA about another person.
But that's par for the course, Chuck, because what they're doing there is they're isolating you. They're putting you, putting additional pressure on you, because now they've got the entire development, and I hate to call them communities because they're not, they've got the entire development against you. And that isolates you and makes you even more vulnerable. They'll lie about you. They'll tell people that you've done things that you haven't. And now all of a sudden you're the enemy, and you're not, you don't have just one enemy, the association. You have every single other member in there who's your enemy. They're afraid of you because they've been lied to about you.
Exactly. Fortunately, I had good witnesses. I mean, I had great people who, again, technically were co-defendants in the case who were going to testify in court on my behalf. So I was very fortunate. I had made a lot of really good friends there. And, you know, there was a small contingent of six, seven, maybe eight people who were adamant. And they, even when they were deposed, they stated strictly, look, this is a personal act of vengeance against this guy because he was complaining about the depth of the marina, yeah, which the president of the association did not care about. And, so I was fortunate in that regard. But anyway, so coming back to this, is going back to the president. So after her deposition, I had only filed the suit against the HOA and the management company. But after her deposition, my lawyer called me. He says, oh, my God. He said, you've got to add her to the suit. I said, why? He says, I mean, this woman just basically rolled over and just admitted that she, this was an intentional act against you because she doesn't like you. And he said, I want to add her as a defendant. And I was like, okay, are you sure? I didn't want to file this to be personal. He says, no, we're adding her to it. So we filed suit. It took forever to get her served. Her husband would be on the other side of the door when they went to serve the suit, and he'd just say, go away, go away. But they were finally able to track her down in a parking lot somewhere and get her served. So I drug her through it, and looking back, I'm glad I did. So when it came down to providing the net worth, financial net worth information, right before we were supposed to go to trial in June of 2015, June of 2015, she refused to do it. I mean, we were coming up on trial, and she still had not produced failure to produce court ordered production. And anyway. So, the judge was getting itchy about it, and so we were ready to file a motion for sanctions and contempt when they filed a petition in certiorari. And if you're not a legal person, few people, I had never heard of such a thing in my life, but it's basically where you go to the appellate court on a opposition or an objection to a judge's ruling or something of that nature. I mean, she did not want to produce her financial documents. Now, her relationship with the developer and a couple of other things that were going on made me pretty suspicious and made a number of other people pretty suspicious, because now we go back into what you deal with a lot with board members and HOAs is the accountability of the money. So So they filed with the appellate court not to produce. And so I was gummed up in the appellate court for about 7 months.
Wow.
But they did not win. They did not receive their ruling. Their ruling was denied, or their motion was denied. And so they went back to the appellate court. The appellate court didn't give them a written opinion. It was just per curiam. And so they went back to the appellate court and said, we want to go to the Florida Supreme Court. Or they went back and asked for a written opinion. And then they said, well, we want to go. And these insurance defense lawyers were like cartoon characters. I mean, it's absolutely, yeah. You want to talk about, there's an old saying about, you know, I was walking through the cemetery with my daughter and there was a tombstone that read, said, here's John Smith, an attorney and an honest man. And she asked me how they got two guys into that hole. But these guys would lie. I mean, some of the stuff they said in mediation, I just wanted to roll out of my chair. But anyway, so the appellate court laughed them out of the hall on the request to go to the Supreme Court. So then we got to reset trial. Well, the problem is now we're 3.5 years into this, and people get on with their lives. Witnesses get on with their lives. People move. People die. I mean, three potential witnesses in this case died during the course of the lawsuit.
Wow.
So, you know, all these insurance defense attorneys have to do is just drag it out, and either A, sooner or later everybody will forget and depositions don't matter, or they're dead. So that's the way to play the game. Now, you know, if you get a good personal injury attorney who will take a case that has punitive damages, you know, that could run up into the low millions or something, and there are cases I'm sure you're familiar with in HOAs where that has happened. I mean, there's one landmark case in South Carolina where a lady was, I think she was awarded $6 million,
yeah.
And then they negotiated a settlement off that. But anyway, so, they drag it out. And so now I'm getting into the 3.5-year mark on this case, and we've got a trial set, and that trial was supposed to be held this past January. But the insurance defense attorneys and their clever games decided that they, one, wanted to redepose me, and I was out of state, and they knew that. And they also wanted to have another mediation. We had actually had a mediation in the summer of 2014 that went absolutely nowhere because that mediation was conducted prior to punitive damages being entered into the case. So they wanted to have another mediation. Well, again, everybody's gotten on with their lives. This mediation was last September. And it was a very difficult mediation, and I need to warn anybody that sues their HOA to be prepared if they go into mediation to have your personal life laid out on the table, and you essentially sit there and you get verbally destroyed, and your attorneys have no power to say anything. And unfortunately, my attorneys did a horrible, horrible job in the mediation. I'm extremely disappointed in them, but I think they were tired. And everybody wanted it to be over. We just want it to be over. We don't want to drag this whole neighborhood into a courtroom in Jacksonville, Florida. And so the mediator really put the hard sell on me. I mean, he put the hard sell. And here's what he said. He said, here's what you got going for you. One, you're going to take an HOA in front of a jury, and nobody likes HOAs. And two, that second letter never should have been sent. And he said, that's what you got going for you. What you got going against you is it's a Duval County, Florida jury where your average juror might make $30,000 a year if they're lucky. So they're not going to understand these numbers. You're a guy with a boat and a marina, and they're going to look at you, and they're going to see this as nothing more than, you know, just a dispute. And so if you win, and he told me, he said, you will probably win just because it's going to be hard finding jurors that are going to have any sympathy for an HOA or a property management company. But he said, if you win, he said, they're not going to get the numbers. And then they're going to go to the appellate court. And I'll tell you right now, the first DCA in Tallahassee is backed up almost 2 years. So you get to live with this for another 2 years. I was offered money, and I had to think about it. It took me several weeks after everything I'd been through. It wasn't a lot of money, but it was enough to say, you know what, I'm done. I'm not going to go through the courtroom process. I'm not going to put my ex-neighbors that I like through it. The emotions are gone. It's been 4 years. And so I took the small amount of money that they that they offered me, that the insurance guy. I will tell you, at the mediation, there were eight people in the room. I mean, two insurance defense lawyers, three insurance adjusters, the property manager, the board president, my two lawyers, and me. I mean, the room was full. And so that's the end of the story. But, you know, I like what I did. I did the right thing. I went as far as I could with it. And at the end of the day, I mean, the only thing you're going to do with a lawsuit is make them miserable. And you're going to be miserable, too. You're getting these cases into a courtroom. I mean, I got close, Shu. I really did. But I was looking at a substantial amount of money to continue. My attorneys wanted to do a mock trial. And I was just, after 4 years, I was exhausted. I didn't want to think about it anymore. Didn't want to think about the place anymore, which I no longer have. And don't ever want to see it again. Don't ever want to be near it. So, but yet, I will say that the friends I made there, I've kept. I mean, I'm close friends with a number of people who I met there. So there's a, I'm in fact one of my best friends in the whole world to this day that I met when I moved in 10 years ago. He and I are still great friends and speak every day. So if there's any positive to this, that would be it. And a lesson learned for me. There you go.
So basically, you settled the case. You accepted a smaller amount of money. Were you made whole again?
No, nowhere close.
Nowhere close.
No, they were willing. They were willing to do it because they knew they had time on their side, and they knew they had the appellate court. And they might have lost in the appellate court. And I will tell you, I can assure you, had they lost in the appellate court, this would have gone to the Florida Supreme Court. And that's what everybody was saying. So it wasn't another year and a half or 2 years. It was going to be probably be closer to three or four. And Shu, I just don't have that kind of stamina.
No, I fully understand. The downside to going to mediation is the mediator doesn't have to know the first thing about law, doesn't even have to know how to spell law. And so it's sort of supposedly trying to get the two sides together. The other thing I don't like about mediation is that it's closed. So the next guy going through what you've been through cannot go back and look at what you've done and build on what you've done. So they're going to have to reinvent the wheel and start from scratch.
I agree.
I think those are the downsides. But to get that monkey off your back, I think you did, you know, you probably did what was right for you. I'm sorry you went through it.
I will interject one thing I wanted to add is, based on the time, okay, and my observance of what my legal fees were, looking at the thickness of their books in the mediation, and I know the time that they put into it, that insurance company, well, it's actually two insurance companies that represented the association and the management company, and then by extension, defended the president, which I was always objectionable to, easily $250,000, if not pushing $300,000. So that insurance company, and that brings us into another show, Shu, because that insurance company was willing to pull out the pockets. They were willing to dig deep to keep that case out of a courtroom and prevent case law, because the first case in the state of Florida that makes it to case law on you know, I can't remember the Florida statute. I guess it's Florida statute 318. That's condominium of law, okay? And they keep monkeying with that thing, and that's why people need to pay attention to what their legislators are doing, because every time a case enters the court system, trust me, that insurance defense lobby, and I know the big giant hotel over in St. Petersburg that they have their annual meetings at, okay? Their job is to make sure that the legislators are keeping these Florida statutes, both 318 is condominium, 320 is HOA, keeping that as locked down as they can so that the individual has no constitutional rights whatsoever.
I went to court to support someone in Virginia, and the attorney representing the HOA was an insurance attorney, and he told us point blank that his goal was to make sure that the HOA won. We can't have these homeowners win. Now, why we can't have these homeowners win is so completely and totally beyond me. I don't understand that concept, but that's how they're going in. We cannot allow the homeowners to win. That's just, I'm going to do everything in my power to make sure that the HOA wins. That's pretty bad. And when you've got
$4 billion a year business.
I'm sorry?
It's a $4 billion a year business. I mean, HOA revenue exceeds NASA's budget. It's ninety-two, ninety-three billion dollars a year
for HOAs. I mean, that's.
I thought it was four, but yeah. Okay,
no, no,
there you
no.
Go.
You're way behind. You are way behind the times, my friend. The last I saw it was somewhere around 92 billion.
Well, I mean, there, that explains it. They don't mind digging in and spending $300,000 to defend a lawsuit. Okay, and that's what they'll do. And they will. And they, it's time and money. They make the money. Insurance defense lawyers make the money, and they've got all. And they're the ones with the time. So, you know, again, I would never waste my time again suing an HOA, but I don't have to worry about it because I'm never going to live in an HOA again.
You know, I want to go back. I mean, I didn't interrupt you. I wanted you to be able to give us your exactly what happened and set the stage for us. When you talked about buying the condo and buying it before it was fully built, and you said the marina, I mean, there were so many, they didn't expect everyone who lived there to want to have a slip. But the marina was not built according to code. From what I understand, it was not deep enough.
Correct, and that's not necessarily code. There's no code when it comes to the depth of the marina. It's just what we were told we would get, and it wasn't deep enough. So at low tide, you know, tides, low tide, high tide.
Right.
High tide, it was functional. At high tide, it was functional. At low tide, it was not.
Okay. Now, when local municipalities, and you were a developer, you've worked in the business. So, but local municipalities sign off on these things because you have to go to them begging, cap in hand, begging for permission to build these things, and you have to cross their palms with some gold before you'll get the A-OK go ahead. So they're making money on it. That money is passed on to the homeowners. And then they're not ensuring that what's being built is being built properly so that it can be used as it is supposed to be used and is not functioning properly.
This particular development was private. It was gated. It was private. And in any private development, and I as a developer can tell you because I did public where I would transfer the streets. I would transfer my work to the municipality. And that was a very painful process. But I would transfer it to them for the city to maintain off of their tax revenue, off of their property tax revenue. This was not the case with this property. It's privately maintained. Again, when I tell you what the dues were, the monthly dues, the association dues, were $1,200. And that wasn't enough money to maintain the property. Certainly not enough money to dredge the marina. And with this particular developer, he had some very, very good and powerful political connections. So pretty much it was a, looking back on it, I feel like it was just it was take the shovel and go, and we don't care what you do. So this one was different in that regard as being a private development. So there was no municipal involvement at all, with the exception of the release of the water, the intake of the water and the release of the sewer.
And they didn't have to get permission to build it?
Oh, yeah, they got permits from
okay,
the state.
Okay, so what do the permits?
Water management.
So and they had to pay for the permits, right?
Of course.
And so what are the permits worth? Because is it just a transfer of money to the municipal government with no responsibility on their part?
Well, certainly not for the depth of the marina. I mean, they had a permit to dig a hole. Okay, I mean, when it comes to that, I mean, dig it however deep you can. I mean, I've got aerial photographs of this thing right before it was filled with water, and I can assure you what happened towards the end of this development. I can guarantee you they went over budget. I can guarantee you that corners had to be cut at the end, and one of the easiest corners at the end to cut was to quit digging because they didn't have anywhere to take the dirt. And so they just said, open it up in the middle of the night, flood it, and nobody will know the difference. That's exactly what happened.
Oh, jeez. I guess what I'm trying to do is start holding the government a little more responsible. Not that I want the government running things, but if you've got to go to them, and if you've got to get permission, and if you've got to pay them, I want them to be more responsible. Their job is to protect their citizens, and I think they're doing an incredibly poor job of it.
I agree with you. I mean, look, it wasn't just the depth of the marina. I mean, it was access to the marina. Access to the marina wasn't to code with ADA, with the American Disabilities Act. And that was another continuous complaint. Instead of using longer, I don't know if you know what a gangway is, but
yeah.
These were floating docks. So that gangway goes up and down with the tide, as opposed to paying for a longer one that would have less of a slope. At low tide, this thing had a 45-degree angle. You couldn't even go down this thing without risking falling. And that was another, ongoing complaint. I reached out, I made sent some emails. I tried, but at the end of the day, it's a private development. You need to get with the developer or your HOA. So we don't, in other words, nobody, there's no jurisdiction over the marina other than the homeowners association itself. It's not like the state of Florida comes in and inspects. It's just, there it is. It's water. They got the permit to dig the hole. They're done.
Okay. That's my complaint, is that municipalities will find all kinds of ways of getting paid, whether they do anything for that payment or not. And that's right. What I object to. Terrible.
Well, that's our elected officials.
It is our elected officials, and I think it's terrible. The other thing I wanted to touch on was, we're always told that condos and HOAs are going to protect property values. It didn't do that with yours, did it?
No, not at all. Didn't come close.
So you actually lost money?
I lost a lot of money. I mean, I don't want to share the number with you because it'll just make me sick. I lost a lot of money.
Okay. No, I don't want you to share the number. I just want to highlight, underscore the fact that that is one of the biggest lies on earth, and people buy into these things thinking that they're going to be protected, that their property values are going to be enhanced, that, the association's there for them. It's not.
Well, it's there for whatever those board members want to spend money on. In our case, the board president, what I like to refer to as her two flying monkeys.
I like that.
We're more interested in drapes in the lobbies and new rugs every 2 months, instead of actually getting to the nuts and bolts of the infrastructure, because, frankly, they didn't understand it. It was over their head. So it's kind of like, it's that old saying, when somebody doesn't understand something, they run from it. Okay, and God forbid anybody that knows what they're talking about objects to it, then they immediately become the enemy.
Well, I think the whole concept of a condo and an HOA is just not workable. It's sort of structurally flawed. And that's one of the reasons, because the people in charge don't know what they're doing. I mean, I could come in and buy in that unit, in that development, and end up on the board. I have absolutely no idea how you run a marina. I don't have a boat. I'm not, but then I would be making these decisions based on stuff that I know nothing about. And if I decide I don't like you and the marina is important to you, then, hey, guess what? Human nature says I'm going to go after you.
That's what happened.
And that's exactly what happened. So with the malice, everybody agreed that there was a lot of malice involved in your case.
Those who testified in deposition. Every deposition I've got, I've kept all of these depositions, and every deposition I have was adamant that this was personal, it was vindictive, and it was meant to harm me. And I think that was widely accepted.
Okay, so that was something that was widely accepted, but were you able to get anything? Did that help your case at all, other than the fact that, hey, but that's just part and parcel of what these associations are? I mean, you've got someone who's not knowledgeable, who's in a position to make these decisions, and they're going to be defensive. So they're going to go after you because you're the bad guy in this case. You're the guy who has created a problem because you're questioning their authority. You're questioning their knowledge. You're questioning their decisions.
Well, I basically blew the whistle, okay? And, I feel sorry, I fear any man or woman that blows the whistle because there was clearly collusion between the board president, who was appointed, all but appointed by the developer. And there was obvious collusion because to dredge that marina, they were looking at probably, to do it correctly, they were looking at close to $1 million, and they didn't have the money. So people will do nasty things to defend their pocketbook, and that's what this was all about.
But what would have happened if the marina was really a nice functional one? What would that have done to property values?
Oh, of course it would enhance it because, look, let's be realistic. I mean, waterfront property in Florida, okay? And by the way, that marina is still by and large vacant to this day. The boats in there are very small. I love how the president used to like to call it a yacht basin and a yacht club. You can't get a 25-foot boat in here. No, it's still largely empty to this day, even though the market's recovered. And I'm up here in Martha's Vineyard, and you can't find a place to park a boat up here. That's if it were done correctly. I mean, I think the word is out. I think people, purists. People who are true boaters, true yacht people, they're smart enough now to do their due diligence, and they're saying, look, I'm not going to bring, my asset in here and run the risk of doing damage to it. And so, if it were constructed properly, they'd probably be looking at a completely different situation. But this particular piece of property, I feel, has gained a reputation in that area. And I think it's a long time coming before the values there will ever see what they were in 2006 when they completed the project.
You sold your property, right?
I got rid of it, yes.
You got rid of it. Okay. What did you get for the $1,200 a month?
What did I get for the $1,200 a month? It was subdivided into three portions. 120 or so of that was to the marina, which wasn't nearly enough. And then the remaining 1,000 was by and large split even Steven. One part of it went to what they called the Master Association, which was the grounds, the gate, which was constantly broken. Lawn maintenance, which a lot of money went to that lawn maintenance because those landscapers were out there every 3 days, it felt like. And then the other portion went to the building itself. So elevator maintenance, reserves for the roof, reserves for painting, cleaning the windows, things like that. And let's not forget that insurance bill. Because I'm wondering what their insurance premiums are now, or even if they've still got that same insurance company. That insurance company couldn't have been very happy.
You know what? I don't feel sorry for them in the least bit. There was a time when I first got involved in all this HOA stuff that if you contacted the insurance company and complained about a board that was acting ultra vires outside the scope of their authority, and the insurance company thought that there might be a lawsuit and it was going to cost them money, they would talk to the board members. They actually had board presidents step down at the risk of losing their insurance coverage, but now they don't do it. They don't care. Now they're just as willing to spend the money and go to court and defend the actions of a rogue board as they
are.
Go on.
Right, because it's now an issue of risk versus reward. The cost of defending choose minimal compared to the revenue that's coming in, so it's worth it for them now. And again, I mean, it's unfortunate, but I think we're seeing kind of a change in the housing industry, a change in who the buyers are. I know that the younger generation just is not in a big rush They much rather travel the world, backpack through Europe, than be tied down to a home. And then, you know, the generation just slightly ahead of me, I'm 50, generation ahead of me, they're done. My folks are going to be in their home for the rest of their lives. And so you're going to see a transformation in this over time. I don't know where real estate values are going. I mean, I know in many places, of course, they're going to continue to skyrocket, like New York City, but, you're going to see less people as this younger generation, as I know it, comes up. They're going to have less and less of an interest in this. They're not going to want to play that game.
They're minimalists. Well, and you know what? They've grown up in these HOAs and they've watched their parents being abused. I hear from people who are afraid of checking the mail, afraid of answering the phone, afraid of answering the door, absolutely terrified. They're sick. Due to the stress of living in an HOA, they don't want the same thing, I don't think. And generally speaking, I think the millennials are minimalists. They don't want things, which is causing, I just read an article, which is causing a bit of a problem between the parents who have spent a lifetime collecting things that mean a whole lot to them, hoping they'd be able to pass it down to the younger generation, to their kids. Their kids want nothing whatsoever to do with it. I mean, they're just
willing to go. It's all going to end up in a storage unit, if they're lucky.
They're going to sell it. Yeah, it's all going to go. So you're absolutely correct in that we are dealing with a whole different generational thing. So what do you think the millennials are going to end up doing? They're going to get married, they're going to settle down, they're going to have families, so they are going to need shelter. What do you think?
I guess I'll just get an Airbnb and get an Uber. we'll Airbnb here now, we'll Airbnb here there. I don't really know. But the picket fence is definitely fading.
There's no need for a picket fence in some place for the dogs, huh?
Right. I see it happening. So, just the car industry. I mean, you know, just hey, get an. They all say the same. All of them. All these kids, get an Uber. So, anyway, I don't need a car. So, anyway, it is what it is.
So, what's going to happen to the existing HOAs?
What you mean in general, as we know it?
I mean the ones who exist right now, the HOAs that exist, the condominiums like the one you're talking about. What's going to happen to them if nobody's interested in them? What's going to happen?
Right, nobody's interested in them, which means the problem will get worse because the oligarian personality, that person, you know who I'm talking about, the one who wasn't the prom queen or didn't get elected student body president in high school, they're going to want to do it. So these people are going to continue getting on these boards. And people who don't care, look, they want to go live their lives, and then they turn around one day and they get a letter in the mail being threatened, and then they have to confront it. That's why I think you're going to see a lot of these kids aren't going to want to be involved with this HOA stuff. And so whoever's there, problem's going to get worse. I mean, it's crazy down in South Florida because you're dealing with a lot of elderly down there. And, you know, I'd hate being a person who's, let's say, 75, 80 years old. And, you know, I'm being singled out. And here I am in the sunset of my life. And, you know, all I did was object because a dog pooped in my front of my door. And, you know, now they're coming after me. I couldn't imagine how horrible that must be.
But that's exactly what's happening. But again, when you have these, all right, let's just take a condominium, because you have a lot of them down in Florida, and you have a lot of elderly in them, and they're going to die off. They're going to move into smaller units. They're going to downsize. Somehow, those units. Somebody's going to have to do something, either that or you're going to end up with all of these condominiums with all these empty units that are not generating an income, that are not paying their fair share. Nobody wants to buy them. They're sitting on the market. What's going to happen to the association?
Here's what's going to happen. Their covenants and restrictions might say that you cannot Airbnb your home, but what will happen is the tide will turn, and there will be more people who aren't interested in living there but can't sell them or don't want to sell them that'll finally push through a change in their covenants and restrictions to allow them to Airbnb. I mean, Airbnb is the big thing, okay? I mean, we do it a lot up here in New England, and you know, that's the big thing. So you're going to see these condominium buildings turn more into hotels over time, I think. This is my opinion. I could be wrong, okay? But if people don't want to live there, they still want to try to get revenue out of their asset. And, you know, I know probably a lot of these condominium buildings, you know, are restrictive in their covenants on Airbnb. But I think you'll see that'll tend to change. People like to travel, and some of these buildings are in nice locations and can fetch a pretty good price per night.
So, yeah, okay, so those are the people who still own them, who are still alive. What about the ones, let's say you've got a building with 80 units, and let's say that 20 of them, you said in the course of your case, three of your witnesses died.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
So what happens if 20 or 25 of the 80 owners die and nobody wants to buy those units? You can't go after a dead person. You can't squeeze blood out of a turnip, as the saying goes. What is the condo going to do? Suddenly,
well, if there's debt on them, the bank's going to take it back.
And the banks are not going to pay, but the banks are going to want to offload them. They're not going to be paying HOA dues.
Well, then the banks will end up. Then the banks will somehow end up on the board, and then I go back to what I said. They become rental units. They will ultimately become rental units, either Airbnb or short long-term rentals.
So it goes back to doing that. So basically, you're predicting the demise of this whole system.
I think so. Again, I'm talking about a different generation. I'm talking about people between 20 and 35 years old who just aren't interested. So, I mean, I don't think the housing issue, we've bounced back, okay? There's been a snapback on you know, we've got a housing shortage right now. We're not where we were 10 years ago in the crash. Now this is the snapback of, you know, literally zero construction that took place between 2008 and 2014. So now we're seeing a snapback in that market, but I don't think it's going to be sustained. There's a chart I could send you. We're only selling half of the new single family homes that we were selling 20 years ago in this country at large. So, you know, we've come nowhere close. Now, at the height of the building boom in 2005, we were at 1.3 million units a month. Average in 1996-97 was about 800,000 units a month. We dropped down to 250 in 2011, and now we're back. But we're not back to that 800,000 unit mark. We're only back to about 450,000, 500,000 a month.
And presumably we're increasing, the population's increasing, right?
Everybody needs a place to live. So you're going to build. There's going to be construction. The question is how it's owned and how it's occupied.
What about all these teeny tiny little places? I call them garden sheds in the back of somebody's house. This new craze, the tiny, tiny house. I mean, you're a developer. I don't know if you still have your hand in developing, or if, I mean, you obviously seem to have all the stats. Is that a thing of the future? Is that where we're headed?
I don't think code will allow it. If any of your listeners have ever been to Martha's Vineyard, that's all over Martha's Vineyard, but they were all built 100, 120 years ago. These little tiny, tiny homes that were, you know, by and large built to house the butlers and the cook staff of the larger Kennedy style homes here. They're all over Martha's Vineyard, and it's amazing the price that they fetch.
Oh, really?
But predominantly what lives in them is the Eastern Europeans, believe it or not, many here that come to work in the restaurants, work in the bars, work in the stores, things like that. The problem with that type of construction is, and I think I've talked to you about this before, is impervious surface. We've passed so many codes with regard to open space and allowable use of space, that you're limited in the impervious surface that you can that you can construct on, and land has value. So, I mean, if you look at me and say, well, you got 20 acres of land, but you can only build on five of it, it kind of makes it, it kind of makes it cost prohibitive. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Chuck, thank you so much. I know you've got a meeting to go to.
I appreciate it.
I appreciate the fact that you took time out to talk to us. Good luck. And please keep in touch.
I will, Sue. And again, I really appreciate it. I've been meaning to talk to you about this for quite a while now, and it was an absolute pleasure speaking with you.
Thanks a lot, Chuck.
See you, Sue.
Bye. Please check out our website at onthecommons.us. On the Commons is produced by OTC Multimedia Productions.
Well, I finally bought my dream home to enjoy retirement life. I've made new friends and buddies, lots of parties for my wife. It seemed that life was perfect, all my neighbors felt the same. Then along came death by CCRs, life's over, I'm fair game. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Now there's lots of open meetings close to justice for HO. Those arrogant board members say what they want you to know. The CAI and ULI will help you lose it all. But I wouldn't sell that dream home yet, the writing's on the wall. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Well, we're not afraid or stupid, all your threats mean nothing here. Time marches on, soon you'll be gone, united we'll be there. So put your rules and CCRs up where the sun don't shine, and enjoy those precious golden years, stop messing around with mine. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell.